This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network. And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes. With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining me again. I'm going to talk a bit about the Judeo-liberal zeitgeist, life under the anti-white regime. And I'm going to provide a couple of examples taken from current events and news to illustrate what I'm referring to. When Obama was elected, the anti-white media described the situation in America as post-racial. And what they really meant by that, of course, was post-white. Racist means white, essentially, for all intents and purposes. The Tea Party rose shortly after Obama's election, and they said that they were upset about taxation and the size of government, and they were upset especially about the recent Wall Street bailout, the bipartisan bailout and socialized health care that Obama was pushing at the time, and town hall meetings that were taking place were starting to get pretty heated. And the media very quickly decided to start calling these people racists, and even though they didn't explicitly identify themselves as white or their interest as being white, or limit themselves to only white people being in the Tea Party in any way, they were too white. It was a matter of fact that it was mostly white people that were calling themselves Tea Partiers and were making these protests. And the media said that, dismissed what they said their grievances were, and said that it was just because they didn't like having a black president. So that's a good example, I think. Just quick, I'm not going to give any cite any specific stories there. I did plenty of that during my blogging at the time when it was going on. The other thing, of course, is that the media makes it sound like if there is a problem with this post-racial utopia that they envision, the only problem really comes from racists, meaning white people, and Nazis sometimes they'll call us too. And that isn't just people like myself, people who talk openly about what's best for whites. When they're calling people racists and Nazis, what they're talking about these days really is anyone who cares about their own interests, even just as an individual, and if they happen to be white, if they go out and demonstrate and they happen to be with a bunch of other white people, well, that's enough to be labeled racist. This can be contrasted with the recent news that about 50% of the births in America now are to non-whites, and how that was touted and celebrated openly. There are people are talking about how this is going to solve the problem, basically, because they're just white people are going to be outnumbered, and they've always talked about being a minority being a bad thing, but white people are supposed to celebrate it. It's very strange, unless you understand it as an anti-white regime. I mean, that's the real purpose of it, is to remove whites from power. And so, of course, if that's the purpose, that's worth celebrating. Of course, it isn't a post-racial society. The politics today and the media are not post-racial. It's more hyper-racial than anything else, and we've had many incidents over the past few years making that clear. The most recent is this whole Trayvon Martin thing, where whites weren't even really involved and yet whites were being blamed for creating and causing the problem. There really is a single principle that you could boil down politics if you wanted to understand American politics at the moment, and that is the principle is whites equals bad and non-white equals good. And in any given situation, if the situation is bad, well, white people must be responsible for it. And if non-whites do something that seems to be bad, it's only really because you don't understand how whites actually caused the problem. And this has become the popular way of understanding just about everything that happens in politics. I'm going to talk today about guilt tripping, which is one of the mechanisms by which this is made clear and taken advantage of. I went online to try and find a citation, a definition of guilt tripping so I could quote it. And, you know, I found the official definition doesn't quite match what I was, you know, the meaning that I mean when I use the phrase guilt tripping. And what I found was funny. It says a guilt trip is a remorse caused by feeling responsible for some offense, which is true enough. But I'm talking about guilt tripping, you know, somebody causing that trip against you. The funny thing is, one of the alternate definitions of a guilt trip, though, is survivor guilt, a deep feeling of guilt often experienced by those who have survived some catastrophe that took the lives of many others. And it goes on to give an example. You know, survivor guilt was first noticed in those who survived the Holocaust. which is kind of the opposite of my point, which is more the meaning of the word guilt tripping, which is what I found finally in the Urban Dictionary, which somebody pretty clearly stated exactly how I mean it, which is when somebody tries to make you feel guilty for thinking or feeling or doing things a certain way, or more specifically, when someone tries to make you do whatever they want you to do. So they start making you feel bad about something so that you'll give in and do whatever they want. And that's exactly the kind of guilt tripping I'm talking about when I say guilt tripping. And political guilt tripping, race-based political guilt tripping is what I'm talking about today. So, you know, it's coming from somebody who's wants something from you, a group, speaking as a group here. And in fact, they're prepared to take it from you, but they realize that this is patently wrong, you know, unethical, immoral, however you want to describe it. So they try to rationalize it, and they do so by describing it in terms of fabricating a narrative, and, you know, a story. They make up a story about where they're a victim and you're an oppressor, and you owe them. So that justifies them taking what they want from you. And they don't just whisper this amongst themselves, because that's not the point. The point is to shame you and guilt trip you and your group into giving them what they want. So they shout it from the rooftops. And we see this in our politics today all the time. One particular example that happened recently, back on June 8th in the Huffington Post, a professor of English at the College of New Jersey, a woman named Cassandra Jackson, looks from the small photo attached to the article, or this is really an op-ed, that she's mulatto, that she's half black, but she seems to identify as a black woman. So, you know, whatever part of her is white, she really doesn't care for. She identifies with blacks as a group. And the title of her piece was called "Why the War on Affordable Healthcare is a War on Blacks and Latinos." And it's interesting the way she phrases that. She's going to explain to us here why we should see it the way she wants us to see it. So that's why she says why the war. But, you know, she won't really explain in detail why, but that's how she wants us to see it, as if she's rationalizing. I mean, that's what she's doing here. What do blacks and Latinos have in common? Well, not much that I can see. I'm neither black or Latino, but they seem to me as different from each other as they each of them are from white people. But that's the key, really, is they're not white. And this is not in my racist imagination that I'm coming to this conclusion. It's from exactly the description that what she writes about in her article. But I want to call attention first to the title, how she uses the word war. And if anybody thinks that my language is somehow extreme or exaggerated, that I'm making mountains out of molehills here by calling it the anti-white regime, well, here's a woman. She's describing it in purely racial terms, and she's describing it as a war. So here, let me read the first couple of paragraphs to give you a flavor for what the argument she's making. As we wait for the Supreme Court to announce the fate of the Affordable Care Act, researchers at the Urban Institute's Health Policy Center have released a report, a study, that indicates that the Affordable Care Act will dramatically shrink racial and ethnic differences in health care coverage. Currently, 21.6% of blacks and over 33.3% of Hispanics are uninsured, compared to just 13.9% of whites. According to researchers, if the Supreme Court upholds the Affordable Care Act, it could potentially cut the black-white differential in half and the Hispanic-white differential by a quarter. So she's making direct comparisons there between blacks and whites and between Hispanics and whites. The fight for affordable health care is a fight for racial equality, she writes. Though many have actively opposed the affordable health care, actively opposed the affordable health care would dismiss this assertion, the bottom line is that if the Supreme Court upholds the law, it will be a huge step toward dissolving fundamental racial inequities in healthcare. Historically, access to healthcare has been so deeply shaped by institutionalized and practiced racism that federal healthcare law is the only means of systematically rectifying disparities. So she's talking here about a fight. In fact, she kind of slips here reveals the truth that it isn't really a war against blacks and Latinos. It's a fight that they're waging for affordable health care for themselves and, of course, their allies. I'll talk about that in a bit. She talks in this highfalutin language about equality and trying to get to equality, fix iniquities and disparities. But what she's really arguing in favor of is she's arguing that the government, the federal government, should pass laws favoring her people. If not in directly in language, then at least in the effect, because she thinks her people are somehow being wronged by the way things are right now. And this, I just want to point out, is exactly the rationale that created the housing bubble. Just to quickly review that, it had to do with the government and people urging the government to try and close racial gaps in home ownership. And so they extended loans to a bunch of people that really didn't qualify for them because of the color of their skin, because of their race. And that produced, in the end, a huge ripoff. I mean, the extending loans to people that really can't afford it comes out of somebody's pocket. You know, remember Tan Stoffel, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Somebody's got to pay. And what it meant in trying to boost black and Latino home ownership was that whites would have to pay more in the end. And in the end, we paid even more when the bankers got bailed out because of the shenanigans that they played with those loans that they extended to the people of color, to use their little euphemism for themselves. She goes on, this black English professor, to talk about, she cites a Greenlining Institute study, which says that opposition to national health care policy can be traced to, quote, racial resentment, unquote, or the belief by whites that blacks simply are not working hard enough and therefore do not deserve health care. This idea has been subtly interjected into anti-affordable health care rhetoric. Remember, claims that President Obama wanted to, quote, pull the plug on grandma so that hordes of uninsured people could step over her body to receive free health care? Do you remember that? I sure do. She continues, who did you picture as the beloved grandma on life support when you heard this claim? It probably was not an old black lady. Now, after all this fear-mongering, it seems that the Supreme Court holds the real power to pull the plug on the uninsured. If they strike down the law, it will impede the cause of racial equality. If they uphold the law, it could set us on a path toward health care as a fundamental human right. The law's implementation would be expected to be complete in 2014, the 60th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education, which ruled that segregation in schools was unconstitutional. I can only hope that once again the court will stand on the right side of history. Well, what she's talking about here really is taking away from whites, and she's justifying that by claiming that whites somehow, by being the people who actually pay for insurance, and that's what we're really talking about here, that blacks and Latinos don't have insurance coverage because they decide not to pay for insurance, and white people do pay for it. And what she wants is for the government to somehow mandate that blacks and Latinos shouldn't have to pay, and that that's how she's going to fix this inequity that she's talking about, this inequality. And all it's really going to do is make it even more unfair for white people. It's going to make whites foot the bill. And she knows it. And she's that's why she's pointing her finger at white people, accusing them of warring on blacks and browns for not wanting that to happen, for opposing that. And some of the rhetoric here that she herself uses is just hilarious. She talks about how the whites have to subtly interject their position into the political rhetoric. That's right, and that's a disadvantage, actually, that whites have to speak in code, and most of them aren't really conscious of this as a white issue, a white versus black and brown. Meanwhile, the blacks and the browns talk very openly about what's best for them and what they should do to get what they want, and guilt-tripping white people as white people to give them what they want. Explicitly, in very explicit language, whereas whites are hampered, hamstrung by the fact that we can't discuss or don't discuss our interests in the mainstream. She talks about fear-mongering and, quote, pull the plug, unquote, as if that was some sort of exaggeration. And then she indulges in the same exaggeration, talking about pulling the plug on the uninsured. Talk about reversing the roles there. I mean, pull the plug on the uninsured by what? Not giving them free health care. That's apparently pulling the plug on them. That's going to kill them. The fact is that they get health care. Anybody who walks into an emergency room will get health care. And if you're black or brown and you don't get health care, well, then you can sue the hospital. And then you'll be a millionaire and you'll be able to afford your health care and not have to wait in any lines in a emergency room. But you'll never be turned away in any hospital in the United States. And this business about not working hard enough, that's not the criticism, I don't think, of blacks. It's definitely not the criticism of browns. They're such hard workers, remember? That's why they were supposed to let them into our country, because they're just such great workers. The real bottom line is they're not paying for the insurance, and that's why they don't have coverage. And they want whites to pay more. So if we want to talk about inequities and disparities, why don't we talk about breaking laws and how the blacks have a propensity for violence, for rioting, for raping, for murdering. Let's compare those disparities and see who comes out with something to feel guilty about and something to fix. And for brown people, it's similar, you know, that they can't seem to stop crossing our border even though there's laws against it. And then once they get here, they can't stop dropping babies, even though they don't have insurance to pay for it. Because the babies get paid for. They go into a hospital and they give birth, and we pay for it. Those of us who do pay for our insurance do pay our bills. And if we're going to talk about inequities, let's talk about the three Jews on the Supreme Court that this is all going to go before. And, you know, there's a lot of talk political news about how sharply divided along ideological lines the Supreme Court is. Well, not the Jews on the court. They're all on the same side. Pat Buchanan commented when the third Jew was being put on the court about the fact that there were going to be three Jews on the court. And he nearly got fired for it. Certainly many people called for his head because he was such a horrible racist and anti-Semite for pointing it out. You know, apparently the disparity in numbers there doesn't it doesn't it's not okay to complain about Jews having a disparity, too much power, too much wealth, too much political say. So eventually he did get fired, so they got what they wanted. And this English professor cites another Huffington Post report, and this is when she talks about the Greening Lining Institute's report, that makes it pretty explicit that it's really just calling white people racist for basically doing what she's doing for black people. I mean, she's saying that this isn't good for black people if this law goes down, and it would be better for black people if it goes through. You know, white people, not even as white people, but just as people, say they don't want to pay more, and that makes them horrible haters and racists. And as an example of that, the story that she links to talks about how during one of the or in the wake of one of the town hall meetings, a swastika was painted on a sign outside of the office of the congressman who had the town hall meeting. And he was quoted at the time as saying, "This kind of hate and racism is bubbling underneath the surface. You hear these people say, 'I want my country back,' but from whom? They feel somebody has taken their country. What has happened to demonstrate that? I think it speaks for itself." Well, what has happened to demonstrate that? The fact that a swastika painted by who knows who is apparently an indication that there's some sort of something wrong with white people as a group, not just the one person who painted something or defaced some sign, but as a group, white people. This is a problem for us. But some black professor posts an article arguing in favor explicitly of her group, her racial group, and against whites, blaming whites. And she's published by the Huffington Post, and I don't think she has – everybody knows who she is. She's not doesn't have to fear for her job. Well, I've written quite a bit. I mentioned the Jews on the Supreme Court, and I'm going to say right now that you know, basically this whole guilt-tripping idea, it comes from the Jews. They set the example. It goes back in history, back before the blacks were emancipated. Jews have been guilt-tripping us with this, telling us this their narrative of history, their history amongst Europeans for 2,000 years, being oppressed. And you know, today in the news, anytime you want, you can open up your favorite source and find news about Iran and who's beating the drums for war with Iran. Well, it's Jews. They want the United States to go to war with Iran. Why do they want Iran to be bombed and destroyed? Well, to protect Israel, to protect Jews. And it really comes down to, I've written a couple of blog posts on this, it comes down to save Jews, other people have to die. And again, I'm not exaggerating. The president of Israel and the president of the United States got up in front of an AIPAC meeting, a bunch of Jews, politically active Jews, financing both the Democrats and the Republicans, and told them that there's going to be a war, and that's why it's going to happen. And they cited the Holocaust, which is, you know, their grievance against white people. Charles Krauthammer and a fellow named Abram both wrote columns about this and blaming whites, well, blaming Americans, let's say that. Krauthammer's title was "Israel Will Strike Iran to Prevent a Second Holocaust." And Abrams wrote "Blaming the Jews Again," and I go into detail in my blog. But what it comes down to is that this idea of the Holocaust, their Holocaust narrative, which really the Jewish narrative of their history and their relations with the white people, is that, you know, you people have oppressed my people, and you should feel guilty about that, and give us what we want. Do what we want you to do. And in this case with Iran, they want Americans to go off and die, killing Iranians, and they want us to pay the bills for it, too. And in the end, after it's all said and done, in decades in the future, they'll be guilt-tripping us about that. You know, you racist white Americans went over there and bombed those people in the Mideast. Shame on you. So for, you know, blacks, the you owe me magic word is racism. But, you know, you hear other related words like segregation or Jim Crow or lynching or slavery. And for Jews, the magic guilt-tripping word is Holocaust. But they also use the phrase blood libel, Jew hater, and the old chestnut anti-Semitism, which justifies them to seek to get you to pay and do their bidding for them. And the blacks are really taking after the Jews when it comes to this technique in politics, this guilt-tripping technique. For Latinos, it's maybe different. It's a little more difficult for them. They haven't been around as long. They haven't been working with the Jews as long. For them, the magic word is immigration restrictionist, you know, or, you know, let's just say it's racism. You know, that's what they tend to call white people that don't do what they want. You know, you paid me to work for you. You paid me to give birth to my multiple babies, and you paid to feed and educate them. And then you tried not to pay for our health care. You know, how dare you? How racist of you. So, you know, this is the state of our politics today. And I'm not exaggerating this. I mean, this black woman wrote an article telling us it's a war. She said it's a, you know, she inverted it and said it's white people warring on blacks and browns. But I think it's pretty clear that that is an inversion. If anything, whites are demoralized and disorganized and certainly not organized as a group like her people are. And look, her people are even in a coalition with the Mexicans that they have very little in common with. I mean, the only thing they really do have in common is that they're both not white. And, well, with the Jews, that taught them these tricks and taught them these techniques. You might even say, some people would say they're white. Why are the Jews doing this? Well, that's for future episodes here. I'll get into that in more detail. But, you know, it's just a fact. That's the way it is. And I think it demonstrates empirically that Jews aren't white. They don't identify as white. White people are oppressors and Jews are victims. And in that sense, brown people and black people share the victim status with Jews. And so they're all on the same side. They're all people of color. Now, I hope that I'm providing here a better understanding of what's going on, why it's going on, so that we can better organize a defense of our collective interests as white people. And I hope that that's what you get from listening to these podcasts of mine. So I'll see you next time, and thanks for listening.